I'm Domi, and well, today's talk is precisely about Bash and what you shouldn't do with it. So I've been doing this for quite some time, possibly like the cursed stuff started around 2019. You may know me from some of those hacks. We will be talking about a lot of them today, so I will not get into it right now. And May?
I'm May, you might know me, if anything, from the compiler crimes domain and a few blog posts that I posted there a few years ago. I usually program in languages that give me a lot of guarantees about the correctness of my program, such as Rust and Haskell, and Bash is really not that. Let's talk about why that is. First of all, Bash is a very wide space sensitive language, and it goes against the common sense of basically everyone who's programmed in any other language, because if you add spaces around the equal sign in an assignment, it's suddenly not an assignment. It suddenly runs a command with like equal sign as one of the arguments. And this is kind of a pervasive problem. Everything in Bash has like weird load-bearing spaces or like parts of the syntax where you need either a new line or a semicolon that doesn't really look necessary to the human eye. But all of that pales in comparison to the issue that's quoting, because yeah, I can see that everybody can relate to this, because if you forget to quote a variable properly, then your script will work fine for most of the inputs, and then it will you will like give it an edge case, and it will break horribly because suddenly your one argument is getting split into three, and because like you have a star in it or something, it like tries to complete file names from disk, and I think this is like the reason why everybody learned to hate white space in path names, and like really, who can blame them? Like there's no reason to trust that any bar script will handle spaces properly unless you wrote it into yourself and know what you're doing. And the more you think about Bash, the worse it gets, because the syntax, like everything has multiple ways to do it with no really good reason for it except for like historical happenstance. Command substitution, like that's the one that sort of makes sense because you have the choice between dollar parentheses and backticks, and the backticks were first, but they're really cumbersome to use if you want to nest them because you need like lots of backslashes. But everything else here, like I don't really see the reason why they kept making stuff up. I would in particular like to draw your attention to the function declaration syntax. Because you look at the parentheses and you might go like, okay, so I put the like names of my parameters in there, right? And like, no, that's not a thing. If you want names for your parameters, you need to handle that yourself. It's ugly. And moreover, like usually languages like use parentheses in like function declarations to then like match it up. Like, oh, it's just like you call a function. That's also not... not the way Bash was designed. Like, if anything, Bash's function call syntax looks more like Haskell. If you look at the for loops, for example, for some reason, like, one of the options looks very much like C. It turns out that Bash has a secret C-like sublanguage where everything you know about the syntax of Bash goes out the window and you suddenly like are writing integer expressions just like you would in C. You can see a cursed excerpt of Bash on the slides right now. If you think about this feature a bit more, you go like, okay, if I refer to a variable in an arithmetic expression, like variables are strings, so it probably like will take the string, parse it to a number, and we're done, right? No, for some reason, if you have an entire expression in your variable, that will get parsed and evaluated as well, which also means that, well, you can have weird infinite loops in your variables, and yeah, if this happens by accident in your script, it's a nightmare to debug. Yeah.
So, we've been talking about variables, but those have been so far mostly based on arithmetic. And as you may know, the dollar sign does a lot of stuff. But everyone knows about the variable interpolation. So you type dollar something to replace that with its contents. What you may not know is that it does everything else. And subshells are easy. Subshells are the simple part, but you also have string operations. And our favorite is the getText-based translation support, because we only found out about this existing during researching this talk, and I personally haven't seen this used ever, like, in any place. So it is a bit unwieldy. What is worth mentioning is that a lot of people are frightened of Bash because of all the weird characters that you put in string in variable expansions. So, for instance, to get the string length, you can put the hash inside the interpolation. But if you want to get an array length, it's very, very similar. And it does a whole bunch of different things under the hood. So it's really easy to mistake, and it's really easy to mess up.
Yeah, so let's talk about trying to write a larger program in Bash. You probably want to use functions for that, because otherwise you will need to like copy-paste everything, and it will be a mess. And if you want to use functions, you probably want to return stuff from these functions. And you go like, okay, there's the return keyword, I probably want to use that. No, the return keyword is only for like the Unix style, return a number from 0 to 255 to indicate whether the function succeeded. And if you want to return a string, that just won't work. So, you might go, well, I'll just print out whatever I want to return, and then I'll capture it with command substitution. And then you find yourself in a problem. Let's say, for example, that you want to have a function that will just generate successive integers to use as identifiers or something. So you declare an integer variable, and you have your function printed out, incremented, and you call your function a few times. You print out the results with declare-p because you're a Bash connoisseur, and you know that if you use declare-p, then you get to sidestep all the Bash weirdness around like interpolating variables and how they get printed, and you get much closer to like the real value of the variable. So you run your script with anticipation, and you see that like no, it doesn't work. And if you think about why, well, this subshell here, what that does is it forks off another Bash process, and it runs your function in that child process. So there's no way to communicate the state changes you do back to the main program. And if you want to modify the state of your program from within the functions, you can't really. So the conclusion is subshells are evil. You need to avoid them as much as possible when it comes to calling your functions. And I guess the only way to really return a value from a function is to like put it in a specially named variable and like have a convention across your code base. And the issue with that is that subshells are everywhere in Bash, especially like if you have a pipeline, then all the parts of the pipeline are like separate subshells. That's why if you like run a command and pipe it to a while loop and then try to parse it in that while loop, and every variable you create while you're parsing it will just be forgotten when the loop exits. And like, this is why. And in this case, there is still a workaround where you can put the command in this like process substitution, and this will like spawn it off in a separate process, and give you a path that goes like slash dev slash fd slash, and like that's that will give you like the std out of the process you just spawned, and the thing here, your while loop that you care about, doesn't get run in a subshell. Apart from that, well, the parameter splitting. You really need to be aware of Bash's quoting rules at all times, or you'll have a bad time. And finally, I'd like to like pull your attention towards like when you bind a variable in a for loop, that variable is gonna be global by default. Even if your loop is like in a function, and you really want to avoid that, because then you get like weird scoping issues and spooky action at a distance, and it's a mess. So always put a local variable declaration before your loops.
So we've talked about how Bash works. We could probably spend the whole presentation on this, but we don't have so much time. And let's talk about how Bash works with the outside now. So as outlined earlier, it was designed, quote unquote, in the 80s. So it was made by Unix people for Unix people with Unix principles in mind. And this means that it's all through files, but not all of those files are actually real. For instance, DevTCP is not with us in the room. It is not real. But this doesn't stop you from actually calling it. And you can, for instance, make a really simple HTTP request through that. So that's not really cares. That's just TCP. What kind of sucks is that while they implemented outgoing connections, they don't never really bothered with listening, so we still need external programs for that, but maybe one day, please. Furthermore, you get more than just stdio, and honestly, this is something I found a while back, and if you don't know Bash, this reads like a joke. No need for named pipes here, and then whatever the heck the cat spewed out. Anywho.
Yeah, so the downsides of Bash mostly is that, like, if you are fine with like all the weirdness and can work around it, you'll find that Bash is quite slow. It's a very basic implementation where everything gets reparsed all the time, so you need to really work on your performance. Also, there isn't really any advanced libraries, because why would there be? Like, if anything, like you can call external programs, but the more low level stuff you want to do, the harder it is to do it with those external programs, and like this tends to mean that you have to write everything from scratch, which isn't always a negative thing, because like you get to learn a bunch. And if you want to manipulate data in bulk, like that ties into the whole Bash is slow thing, but like it depends on how liberal you are with like, I want to write this in Bash, because you can call a lot of like this weird utilities that have been designed to work with Bash. So that raises the question, where do you draw the line?
So for myself, I draw the line somewhat liberally. Grep is Bash, sed is Bash. Awk is kind of fuzzy because it's a whole language. We'll get to that later. But Perl isn't Bash. Every time I see an answer on Stack Overflow saying, oh, just use this Perl one-liner to parse this this string, my blood is boiling, because this is not what you should be doing with Bash. Especially since in most cases you can actually use other utilities for this. Meanwhile, May's approach is a bit more drastic.
Yeah, I got into writing stuff in Bash basically as a creative restriction, because I went like, all these languages are like too powerful, and I get the urge to do things the correct way. And turns out, you can just sidestep that entirely if you write your silly thing in Bash, because then you go like, well, there's no way I'm gonna have it like 100% correct. So I get to like cut corners vaguely liberally, and it gets you out of the paralysis of like, I really need to do this properly because I really hate refactoring. this is really where the fun part of this talk starts, because we want to talk about all the weird things that shouldn't be done in Bash, but we did it anyway. So, Domi.
Oh, no.
So, given that it's 2024, I think that most of you have used the internet. I'm sorry, my condolences. which means that most of you have used HTTP. HTTP is a protocol made in the 90s explicitly to transfer hypertext data, so web pages. It has been abused to transfer everything on Earth, literally. And this means that it's incredibly versatile in terms of what you can use it with. And having a server for it is kind of useful. So 4 years ago, I have asked myself, I wonder if I could make a server. So the pro of HTTP is that it's a really, really simple protocol. Is it possible? Well, you have the whole code on screen. The only thing this does is actually check if we have parsed the whole header part, and if we did, then off we go, and we send a success. If we run it, we can curl it, and it returns a meow. So yeah, that's it. Thanks for okay. No. We wanted to serve files. This would be cheating. So let's get to how I actually did this. This is the source code of HTTP.sh, and we start with declaring some helpful variables, and then we go right into the main parser loop, because I like doing these things fast. So if we look into the parser loop, we do a few things to make our life easier, and afterwards we just check for our headers. This is really, really, really simple. If we scroll a bit lower, this is a bit cursed. So what we're dealing with here is we get unknown data. We cannot really say that, oh, this will definitely have this format or another format. And there are a bunch of problems in Bash with parsing unknown data, splitting it, and escaping it. So I have circumvented a few shortcomings of sed in here with using special characters from Unicode that shouldn't really appear. This is kind of a hack, and I will probably rewrite this sometime, but this is beyond the point. So this extracts the path from the get request. If we go further, then we have valid file checks and also custom node support. This was coded later, this doesn't matter for now. Those valid file checks set the status variable, and if we go even further, then we check which is the status on the end of the main file. If it's 200, then we go to the handler for the success, which is quite simple. We either convert the file to a desired encoding, or we just cut the file if it's not text plain. What this does is returns us a file, which doesn't look too exciting, but that was a real file on the file system, not just something hard-coded, so that's nice. But yeah, this is not the only thing that HTTPSH does. If we go back to the previous slide, we can see that it also checks for a configurable extension, which by default is .shs, stands for shell server, and if it does match, then we run a script. How does how that works is you can write your own scripts that use Bash and some internal HTTPSH functions, and through that you can make web apps, which is kind of cool, because the one thing I like about Bash is that I can prototype it really, really fast, and I can do dirty hacks, and this is exactly what I've been doing. So, from some really cursed things that I've done with Bash, on the On the left, we have BashTube, which was my main way to watch YouTube from 2020 until a few months ago. I really don't like the new redesign, so I decided that I will not have it and I will not use it. I only stopped using it because it was a pain to maintain, plus there's a rehike, which is really cool. And the one on the right is a clone of Downtime Robot, which is basically a service that I wrote in HTTP SSH that pings a whole bunch of hosts and reports me some nice graphs. Those graphs are also generated in inside Bash, so it's all in Bash. This is really cool. As in, okay, technically the graphs are in Awk, but this is beyond the point. We will talk about Awk later. Furthermore, 2 years later, HTTP is passé. I wonder if I can do more. This has been actually something that I've been thinking about for quite a long time between 2020 and 2022, and the main problem was it's a binary protocol, so we need to parse binary data. And if you know anything about Bash, you know that, you can ingest binary data, like we just did with the first snippet, but if we run the second one, then Bash helpfully tells us, no, we will ignore your null bytes, thank you very much. And the problem is you have no way to really detect this. There are workarounds, which we will talk about later, but for the most part, if you just read binary data, then it will skip all the null bytes mangling your input. This is not fun. One evening, I've had the realization, hey, what if we just parse a hex dump? So we use XXD to turn the binary data into ASCII, and then we can read the ASCII. That's fine. So that was the first major thing done. And the power of hindsight is that you don't even need XXD to do this. Through some really careful use of Bash primitive read, you can just make a loop that does this for you, and it is almost exactly as performant as XXD, kind of depending on the code path and how big your read blocks are, but this is quite fast. So this was the first thing done, but there was a second problem, data manipulation facilities. What I mean is Bash doesn't really have anything to actually parse the data, so we will need to write all of that ourselves. But before that, I would like to briefly talk about the Minecraft protocol. So as you may know, it is fully binary and it is fully bespoke. It has been designed by Notch, then changed a bunch of times over the years. It includes a whole bunch of custom data types, which we will need to implement at least partially. And the connection starts with a handshake. This is kind of a state machine, like a very simple one. Depending on how it goes, you either get some metadata for the server list, or you get a real game connection started, which requires like more packets to be sent. And the thing is, we don't really need to implement a lot of the protocol to do the first thing, which is kinda nice, because it meant that I could iterate really fast. So first night I started just writing. Mostly I opened Wireshark and I started copying large chunks of data, seeing what I can change. And at around 4 a.m. I got to this point where I got my server onto the list. And that isn't really, like, this is not at all remarkable, because we don't have a lot of the data parsing facilities yet. We are just throwing things around. But this was a really nice thing to go to sleep on. And the next day, I decided to actually tackle the rest of the project. So binary manipulation. Biggest problem is Bash doesn't do floats. And this is a problem when you're interacting with a protocol that really needs floats. So a quick primer. I think that a lot of you are actually familiar with this standard. TLDR. This is the agreed upon way to store floats. The problem it intends to solve is that you can't really store flows efficiently. They chose to use scientific notation for that because this means that we lose the least amount of data per byte, per number, whatever. So if we have a float that's in hex, three FC and then zeros, we can convert that to binary, which is this. And if we split it, then first we have a sign, then we have an exponent, and then we have a mantissa. This has taken me a bunch of time to visualize in my head, but the gist of it is, if you take the exponent, which is biased, which means that you need to add 127 to it to get zero, then use that as a power of 2, then you add another power of 2 times the mantissa, then you get the number. In our case, this is 1 plus a half, which is 1.5. The problem I got stuck on for a bit was that my code wasn't really performant. And this was due to the fact that what I wrote used for loops, and if you do a lot of stuff in for loops every damn loop, then it will not be performant. This is not exclusive to Bash, this is just basic computers. And my solution was kind of messy. I would have done it otherwise if I were doing it now, but I decided to use awk. So I rewrote the whole part that actually counted numbers in awk, and I transplanted a few things to make it actually ingest and output data. And that worked, and that was around 10 times faster than using normal bash, which can give you a bunch of an idea how performant bash is in some circumstances. If I were writing this today, I would likely get rid of all of those, as in I wouldn't have used subshells, and this would make it faster, as well as a few other things, but like power of hindsight again. So those were all of our problems fixed, and now what's left is to implement the protocol. So I wrote a small parser, and what I got to was I basically had something to check what the packet type was, and I implemented a few things to mangle the data, as in to actually get the data into what we want it to be. And what is really important here is those hooks. So hooks is what I envisioned as an API for Witchcraft, which was basically I had a file with dummy functions that didn't do much, but you could override those functions with your own script. And with this, you could really simply write plugins that did a lot of stuff without actually changing the underlying code of Witchcraft, which was really nice. One such plugin can be seen here. So this is a very simple mini game type thing, which is basically you mine stuff to get points, and the points are later tallied down on the very end. As you can see, it is actually quite fast, like it's real time, which is not easy to do in Bash, but I am mining stuff and I am actually like seeing the change happen immediately. Same with the level, if you look at the bottom of the screen. Also, we have some concurrency, so you can see that the time left is going independently of me mining anything, so I had to write some async code for this, and then we got tallied the score.
Yeah, so this is really cool, but when I think of like, oh, what if I wrote something in Bash, then my first idea for the something is a compiler. Cursed CC, as I called it, is a compiler for currently only a subset of Bash, of C, sorry. It's I'm currently at the point where I'm implementing all the like type analysis to be able to handle more than just ints. And like almost all of it is in Bash. I invoke their name at the very start to like handle being invoked for a symlink. And then if the user requests it, the C preprocessor and linker. But all the actual compilery bits are in Bash. And I don't want to go too deep into how the compiler works, because then this will turn into a compiler talk. But if you like don't know anything, then this will be a bit hard to understand. So let's maybe do a quick primer. A typical compiler will start by lexing the source code, which is and the idea is to like split it into tokens, and a token is basically the intuitive thing, like you can put spaces between those but not within tokens, and you see here my debugging output that shows like how a very simple program is getting split into tokens by my compiler, and then what you do is you parse it into this so-called abstract syntax tree. The idea here is like you resolve all the precedents and like understand the whole structure of the code. And if you think about it for a moment, this is where we get the first like Bash specific issue, because variables in Bash can't really store much. Yeah, like you can have strings. You can have strings that pretend to be integers, because like if you declare an integer variable, it will like get round tripped through strings for some reason. And apart from that, you get arrays, which is like nice, but those arrays can only contain like strings and those integers, so you can't nest them. So I thought about it for a bit, and I did what all the frustrations do, which is like flatten it into an array, give each node like an identifier that's like its index in the array, and then, well, a bit more cursed thing than what we do in Rust is that, well, all the nodes have to be described by strings and not structs. But like, hey, space-separated things are something Bash is great at. Yeah, and you might think this is a bit cumbersome to work with, but not really. You just need to write a few helper functions. This is mknode, which like creates a node in the AST, and it's just two lines. You see like what index will the new element of the array have, and then you append the argument to the array. And this is how it gets used. This is an excerpt from the code that's responsible for parsing while loops. So you basically go through like all the syntactic elements of a while loop. You go like, okay, first there's a while keyword, then there's a left parenthesis, then we need to parse an expression that will be the condition, close the parentheses, then we need to parse the body of the loop, and then we create the node by just doing simple string interpolation. Because of the calling convention where like the return value is in the res variable, this gets returned implicitly. And this is how you use it on the other side, how you consume the nodes. So if we're doing a function call, then we need to like resolve the name of the function. We need to unpack the node that we get from that. And we say that, well, we expect it to be a declare variable node. The type of that variable should get into the TY bash variable, and all the other things we don't care about. And if it's not a declare variable, it will throw an error. And there's another variant which will only check, like, is it the right type? And if not, it will, like, return a failure from the function so we can handle it and emit a diagnostic. And you might think, like, hey, how do you do that thing where, like, you get a variable name as an argument and you, like, actually put somewhere into it? And that's done by using a relatively obscure Bash feature, which is references. You can see that I declare a variable using the dash n modifier. And that means like at first you assign some other variable name to it. And then this reference basically redirects all the reads and writes to the variable. this approach is really nice. It took me a while to realize, like, I probably should implement this, and I really regret not doing it sooner, because it makes debugging so much easier. If you refactor something and suddenly the node that you expected to be of one type is of another type, if you don't do the checks at runtime, you'll go mad with debugging things. And because of how I wrote those little helper functions, if something doesn't match, I just emit like internal compile error, here's a bug trace, here's exactly where the problem is in the code, here's where the node comes from that you're trying to unpack. Because I lied to you earlier, when I make a node, I actually added some stuff to like track the position from the source code by like checking the parser state. I don't know. Fun fact, you can just ask Bash, like, hey, where did this function get called? And it will tell you. It's really good for error handling. Unfortunately, you can't catch all errors, because if you ask Bash to like error out on an undefined variable, it will do that immediately, and I don't see a way to catch that and also emit a backtrace. If you figure it out, please let me know. And one last thing I want to tell you about how Bash ties into the compiler is how scopes get handled. Because when you're going through like the structure of some function, you get these situations where you need to go like, okay, add this variable name, I need to like go through all the scopes that have been created and check like where is it declared, if anything. If you go with the traditional approach, it's quite hard to do, because you can't really pass an array as an argument to a function. All functions get called like normal programs, and you can't fit an array into argv in a good way. So what I do instead is I define a variable that is like, oh, the variables in this block. Because Bash is dynamically scoped, while I'm still processing that block of code, all other functions that I call while I'm processing it can access the local variable. And this is a feature that I've only seen in one other language, and that language is Common Lisp. And of course, they did it in a much better way, where you actually have to opt in. With Bash, like every variable is like that, which is mostly a pain. But here it came in really useful. This is the simple case. The vars and block variable is used to like see if we are allowed to create a variable with a given name. It's okay to like reset it to an empty array each time we enter a new scope. We also want to be able to resolve variables that are in all the upper scopes. So what we want to do is basically create a local variable that has the same contents as what already exists in a variable with the same name, except with the new variable will have like a smaller dynamic scope, so the modifications we make to that will like get discarded at the end of the current function. And the problem here is that there isn't really a way to copy a Bash array easily, especially if you want the copy to have the same name as the original. So what I do is I ask Bash to print out the variable using the syntax would have to be used to declare it, and then I like pipe it into eval. And this works, but there's this like subshell, and subshells are kind of slow. And this is where I find like the most obscure Bash feature ever, which is if you do like a parameter expansion and you do like this weird add capital A, it does the same thing as declare dash P, but without a subshell. I don't know why this exists. It probably got used like 3 times in the entire lifetime of Bash, but it does exist, and it's nice. And I don't want to talk a lot about C, but I spent a lot of time reading the C standard while working on this project. So here's like a fun tidbit. If you are declaring a global variable, it's allowed to like repeat yourself as long as only one of the declarations has an initializer. Also, you can have like weird, seemingly conflicting storage class specifiers. So like first you say, oh, this is a static variable, and then you go like, oh, actually it's an external variable, and that's okay. But if you swap those two around, it stops being valid. And I know which exact like parts of the standard make it so. I have no idea why they did it. But yeah, if you want to know the details, like I guess talk to me later. And I should probably also mention that there's a book about writing a C compiler. It's currently in early access. I haven't actually read it because I couldn't find like the budget to buy it. But the test suite is public, and it's really good if you want to write a C compiler. Which, if you're masochistic enough, I guess you do want to. You'll find me in the GitHub issues saying like, "Hey, this test has undefined behavior," or like maybe add this test case. So that is my C compiler.
Holy crap, C in my Bash talk? It's more likely than I may think. So, seeing this slide, you may think, oh, she will be doing something with ANSI characters. So like block characters for changing the color in the terminal, you know, the classic thing. Hell nah, man, we are writing a Wayland library. So, the protocol isn't actually that complicated, and it's actually quite well documented, for what it's worth. There are some resources on doing it, like doing applications without any libraries. Thank you to the guy named Philip from like the article that I linked. And it goes really well until we encounter shared memory. And Bash can't really deal with shared memory because we cannot pass a reference to it through a pipe. The mechanism of how it works is actually really interesting and really arcane, but it's kind of too hard, too complicated to explain on this talk. So I invite you to read how shared memory works on Linux or POSIX in general. But the gist of it is, we need to use shared memory for Wayland. I don't think there is any other way, and there isn't really a way. The problem was that I actually already implemented everything before. As in, I got to this point and I noticed, oh crap, I can actually use what I just wrote. So I had a whole parser. For instance, we have the pixel types, as in the color types in here dumped. This is what the server returns when you launch an application. And yeah, I couldn't really use it. But some days later, I thought, wait, maybe Xorg? And it turns out that, yeah, it is possible. So basically, everything happens to, over a socket because it was designed as a network protocol. Nowadays, it's mostly listening on listening on TMP X11-0, you know, just as a Unix socket, not a TCP socket. But yeah, we can use that. And the protocol isn't hard. It is a bit bespoke in a few places and contains a few really weird design decisions. But I kind of get why they did it, considering that it was an academic affair, and it got forked a bunch of times, it got weird contributions from different places, then people actually started using it outside academic places, and yeah, the history is really messy. Everything is bolted together onto Xorg, for better or for worse, and this means that our code will not be pretty either. So the problem is that Xorg is huge. This mostly means for us that we will need to implement quite a lot of functionality, but it also means that finding docs for what you need is actually a nightmare. So for instance, if you search for a GUI programming tutorial from the last 15 years, you get Qt or GTK. This is two levels above Xorg, actually, because you have the library you use, and then that library uses possibly libx11. And if you go a bit further than that, then most code snippets will assume that you use libx11 directly. This is still not something that I would like to do. I have no way. So I needed to find something that actually does this directly. And I found one tutorial. Oh, wait. Yeah, the docs hacking suck. I said this already. I found one tutorial on how to do this from the same person that wrote the Wayland one. And they decided that it's a really good idea to try learning x86-64 assembly by writing an Xorg application. So the most I can say is, hats off to you, Philip. Thank you very much. I used his tutorial to actually have a concept of what I need to do in Bash. So the very minimal thing is you need a graphics context, then a window. You need to map the graphics context to a window, and then optionally you need to draw something and maybe handle events. Let's go in vaguely the correct steps. So firstly, we need to write handshake. Handshake is something that was already on screen earlier, that's the hello packet, but we also have a whole bunch of other things that Xorg just spews at you. This isn't really parsable like a normal packet. I mean, it kinda is, but it's complicated, and yeah, I kind of made a mess here. This will be fixed. But the important parts are we have the base ID and the mask. And this is what we use to determine what namespace the IDs Xorg wants to actually use. This is dynamic. We cannot hard code this. If we want to send packets, we can write this small primitive. This is taken... I've read some docs... and I also used a lot of that tutorial from earlier. The if is here because we need to ensure that every packet ends on a boundary of 4. This is made to ensure that the length is actually, to fit a lot more bytes in a packet with a short length field. Then we can use that primitive to create a graphics context. And this is kind of taken, again, from the tutorial, kind of from the docs. And we are passing some magic values because we kind of don't need to care. So we can send this. And later in the application, we turn... if we want to actually get the response to it, we need to parse events. And the problem is the event packets, the response packets can arrive at any time. So they can arrive in response to our packet that we just sent, but the user can also press a keystroke. And that's a problem. We cannot really ensure that the keystroke will arrive at a time when we can parse it. And we cannot rely on the application to pull for those because we are a library. So we need some way around this. And the thing that I came up with was, hey, let's put everything the user writes in an async code block. So you have the parentheses and you have the ampersand, which basically says, hey, put this into a subshell and run it outside of everything else. And then our real library code actually ends on a while loop that does the parsing itself. And this creates a whole bunch of issues, but we have a window now. So those are some things that I will probably handle in the future. Right now, I'm happy that this works at all. But yeah, this isn't the end of, this is not what I wanted per se. I can display a text in a terminal, no problem. And if we get deeper into the bashes with Xorg, it quickly becomes apparent that bash is slow. So we need some optimizations. Take for instance, those are the binary conversion functions. So the first one is for a byte, the second one is for a short. And ignore the from short shenanigans, this is for Xorg, this doesn't matter right now. But what you need to know is this will inevitably be slow. You can make it a bit faster if you don't use subshells, but it will still be slow because calling a printf is slow. So what we can do is we can, at the very beginning of the program, pre-cache all the values, because why not? We have the memory. And then we can reference an array with those values. And this is much faster already. But what if we went even faster? So the XOR also uses 32-bit values, which are longs, and we cannot really guarantee, we cannot really pre-cache all longs. We do some pre-caching around here, but we can only pre-cache a few thousand of those. So what if we guessed what values XORG is actually gonna use? So we take the XORG ID base and we increment that by some set value, and with that we can basically pre-cache everything that XORG will ever want to try to use, and this is much faster. With this, I made a little demo. So we launched an application, and this is what it does. It's... So this is running real-time, and it's pegging 100% of the CPU. This is because on every write to Xorg, we are actually randomizing the color and doing a bunch of other really expensive computations. But nonetheless, this works. And this made me think, can we do sound? So Xorg doesn't really do sound. It was designed for window transfer between a mainframe and a terminal, so there was no point in doing sound on a workstation. Let's evaluate a few of the popular options. So we have Pipewire, which is the hot new kid at the block, and the problem I encountered was that it also uses SHMs. So just like with Wayland, we cannot really use it. I don't think so. Please prove me wrong. Then I looked at ALSA, and that looking was mostly limited to me doing ls/def snd and going, oh yeah, those are things. And I decided against it because I don't think that interoperability could be as good as with Pulse Audio. So I tried implementing the Pulse Audio protocol for Pipewire Pulse, and well, the main problem is that the docs suck. I started by just launching Wireshark, piping an application through it, and I could notice some things, but I really needed docs. And when you get down to it, the docs are like, the docs for the binary protocol are almost non-existent, and the source code is what it looks on the very top. So the second picture is my reaction. And the third picture is right before I had an epiphany. So, if I cannot read the original source code, what if someone rewrote it in Rust? And what do you know? They actually did! You may not believe it, but this data structure is what I've been looking for like 4 hours in the original Pulse Audio source code. I didn't manage to find it, and it took me around 15 seconds to find in the Rust source, and I'm not even good at Rust. But yeah, this was already a lot, but if we go further, then we also have just like deserialization primitives that do exactly what I need. I can just copy those things into my code. Not very bad, but I can base it really heavily off of those. So this is nice. Looking at some examples from the Rust library, we have to authorize, then set a client name, create a playback stream, and write the actual data, which is writing memblocks. Technically, this isn't compliant with what the server wants, and it gets really mad at us after a while, but we don't care about this. This is enough to make it work. So I wrote a generic parser for the proto, and beyond the usual binary affair, which we've talked about before with other protocols, we have this funny tag structure, which I showed the tags on one of the previous slides. And when we get to a prop list tag, it turns out that prop list is actually just, again, the same tag structure. So the funny thing I decided to do was, hey, what if we made it recurse? So this parse function is actually calling itself later, and when it's done with parsing the prop list, it just returns and continues with the main loop, which is really nice for code repetition, because suddenly I don't need to write everything thrice. The minimal demo is actually really small and concise. It's a bit hacky, and for instance, we don't have any rate control. We have quite a lot of hacks, and pens are rewrite, but like it works. And I created a little demo with both X11SH and the Pulse Audio library for your enjoyment. Yeah, and it actually crashes at the very end, as in, Pulse Audio part stops working, but this doesn't matter, I will fix it sometime. I know why it's broken, I just didn't have time. So yeah, this is the whole thing. If you have any questions or comments, this will be the time. Please join us at IRC. We will be talking about this and other cool things if you so desire to talk with us. And yeah, thanks for coming.
Thanks a lot for the talk. We have, I would say, 3 minutes left, and I would like you, so I guess everybody has many questions, but I would like you to ask questions that are not really how do I do this, but maybe meta questions, why did you do that, or why shouldn't I something. Yeah. So the technical things, I think you can do later a witch hunt and try to find them. So who has some questions? I think he was first.
Have you considered doing this in POSIX shell?
Yes, I did, but this is, I think, something that would be more accustomed for May, because May is a masochist and likes to do things the hard way.
I don't really have much experience with the POSIX shell, and like in Bash you get a lot of useful extensions that actually let you not do subprocesses. I'm not too familiar with it, but I feel like POSIX shell would be much more limited. And I don't know, maybe you can look into it and do a talk in a year.
For the C compiler, you used a test library. How about the other stuff? Did you, like for all the projects, did you use some kind of tests for this, or was it just changing stuff, executing it, okay, it crashes or it's doing some output?
So
the
way I use Bash is basically I need something that iterates really fast so I can change a thing, launch it, and I immediately see the result. So this is how I write everything, and this is a problem I have with many other languages, because if a language complains that I haven't used a variable that I set, I immediately don't want to use it, looking at you, Go. Technically, I should write some test suites for this, but this is something that I delegated for later, because this will need a lot of code that could be otherwise reused, and I haven't really put enough time into making a meta library of everything I use. So this is a VIP. So far, I've been just iterating manually, but this is something to look into in the future.
Yeah, this kind of borders on my question. I was asking if you thought about writing a unit testing framework and also a CI/CD pipeline completely in Bash.
I have been actually thinking about this, but then I migrated my GitLab instance to Forgeo, and I think you should go to the Forgeo talk tomorrow. Hi, Notus. And I didn't really have a use for it. It would be cool to do sometime, like in my lifetime, but I haven't really touched it. What I would like to do is a really simple Git web interface in Bash, because I think this is totally doable, and I think this is just an evening of work, so maybe.
For the wellenching, I'm pretty sure you can directly access a process memory in the proc file system. So have you considered doing something cursed along those lines?
The problem is, the way shared memory works is you have a pipe, and what you know about pipes is that they can transfer data in two directions. What you may not know is that they can also transfer so-called ancillary data, which is additional metadata that you don't usually see. There are no ways to actually transfer ancillary data in Bash unless you use GDB. And I really thought about using GDB, but I decided against it. Maybe this is something to revisit later. And I like your idea with using the ProcFS for reading processes memory. I have actually wrote some Bash snippets to do that earlier this year. Because, picture this. I have an Android phone that's rooted. I need to dump a processes memory to find a string, and I don't want to install, like, the whole debugger and whatnot. So I just run su, and then I read maps, and I read with DD the specific parts of memory that interest me. This is really cool.
So, unfortunately, we cannot do more questions. Please keep them for yourself. Write them down, and try to get them answered later.